coming to you live from Empire State University. It's the X-Men Test Podcast presenting
Spider-Man and his amazing friends, Iceman and Firestar.
That's right. We are taking a break from our regularly scheduled broadcast to present you a wacky fun bonus episode where I talk about one of my favorite cartoons from whence I was a child, an episode of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, more specifically, A Firestar is Born. Now, this show, this episode particularly premiered in, I think, 1982 or maybe 1983. If you've never seen it, never heard of it, it's easy to find. Just Google Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, A Firestar is Born. Click on the video section of Google, and then it'll appear right at the top. I don't know how legal this presentation of this episode is, but it's right there for anyone to just watch at a click of a mouse. So I suggest, if you've never seen it, to give it a watch first. It is totally worth it. It's hilarious. It's just everything that's campy and kitschy about pre-X-Men animated series Marvel Animation, both in animation style and in vocal and music presentation. Well, actually, I'm going to take that back right away. The animation style is not terrible. It's pretty exciting. There's some scenes that are pretty nicely drawn and interesting to behold, but everything else is ridiculous and totally a product of its time, and perhaps contributed to why Marvel properties took about 3 decades before people start to take them really seriously as pieces of dramatic fiction. Now, if you're wondering where our old pal Sonya is, currently right now she is in bed recovering from a horrible illness. I myself have been incredibly sick this weekend. That's why this episode's coming late. I wasn't even planning on doing this today. Thank you for all the well wishes on Facebook from our fans. It means a lot to us. But, you know, I'm feeling just good enough to do something silly, and I really have nothing else to do today. So it'll come as a little late President's Day bonus. By the way, my name is Willie Simpson, if I haven't said so before, but you all know who I am. So, if you've listened to the, it was an earlier Wolverine episode where I also talked about Spider-Man Homecoming in Season 2, you're going to know how stupid and wacky I'm likely to get all by myself, left to my own devices, made especially more troublesome because we are doing a ridiculous 1980s Marvel cartoon. Anyway, let's get down to the show. So, this show begins, as you heard, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. It was a spinoff of the Spider-Man animated series from the, I guess it was from the late 70s. Maybe it was premiered in the 80s too, where it's there was like a second run Spider-Man series. The original one was from the 60s with the famous Spider-Man theme song that we all know and love. But this one was a little bit more sophisticated, the animation a little bit more updated. And in this series, he has two friends, both mutants, one Iceman and the other Firestar, a character wholly created for this series. I did the minimal amount of research required to present some tidbits about this show. Essentially, Marvel wanted to do a Spider-Man in College spinoff with both Iceman and the Human Torch from the Fantastic Four, but due to complicated rights deals with the Fantastic Four that would come to plague Marvel going throughout the decades, even up to this day, they couldn't really have the Human Torch. So they created this new character, essentially the female Human Torch, which, you know, is a bit more interesting than three men in college living in a dorm room together. Now, Firestar, like I mentioned, wholly created for this series. She essentially has the Human Torch's power. She can summon fire, use heat, turn into flames, shoot fire at people, and fly around. Iceman is... The voice actor of Iceman is Frank Welker, who we all know as Fred from Scooby-Doo, and he's done a million other voice characterizations through the years. He's an extremely well-known voice actor, but you know, in the early 80s, he's going to give you a goofy all-American man voice, which he does for Iceman. Another interesting note that I read on some Wikipedia page is that Iceman and Angelica are essentially modeled after Flash Thompson and Mary Jane as far as their appearances goes on this series. So they just took the stock Frank Flash Thompson and Mary Jane Watson stock drawings they had and just repurposed them as Iceman and Firestar. So that's the kind of animation universe we're talking about here. The show begins. It's got a really thrilling introduction. Spider-Man's crawling around with sort of like a translucent trail tracking him, which I love to see. A great early 80s special effect. We're seeing the premise of the show is that they all go to college together. Empire State University, the famous Marvel fictional New York City-based college, which I guess is analogous to Columbia. Because, well, at least Spider-Man's a genius, so he's going to be at Columbia. And we sort of see they're chilling in their fancy midtown dorm room. Who knows what the rent was in the early 80s. It might have not have been too unaffordable in that time, immediately following New York City's debt crisis and bankruptcy. And, you know, President Gerry Ford telling New York City to drop dead in the famous headline. If you know your 1970s, 1980s New York City public housing history and things of that nature. So who knows? But they do have a swanky midtown pad. And then and they've got a poster of the Incredible Hulk on the wall. But then even more swanky, they actually move a trophy, and the dorm room magically transforms into a technological lab with supercomputers and other things going on. So that's the so they are really they really got their own Batcave. And then we see them sort of, you know, go to save the day. There's an enormous like fire monster the size of the Empire State Building crashing around Midtown. It's an enemy that Iceman defeats with a wave of his finger. He just shoots one ice blast at it. It turns to ice and Spider-Man kicks it. And then we see the X-Men, not the X-Men, although we're going to talk about them. we see the Green Goblin, Spider-Man's arch nemesis, flying around, but he's quickly incinerated to death as Firestar flies around him and engulfs him in flames. So goodbye, Green Goblin, you're dead. I just like to think that Firestar just destroys him or burns him alive. And then what else do we see? And then we see Dr. Doom is the last sort of villain, but he's just caught in Spider-Man's web as the title credits reappear. And so that's what's going on. It's a wacky, wacky world with magical Batman-esque caves transforming out of nowhere. And actually, I did some research on that. I guess they established in an episode that Tony Stark gives them this technology because he helps them on a mission. So that's how they get to have this impossible dorm room with futuristic computers for the 1980s that are, you know, essentially have big knobs and, you know, screens with those green, like, pie lines on them. You know what I'm talking about. Like heart rate monitors. That was the depiction of computers from that era. They didn't have Macintosh, like an early 1980s Macintosh. They had sort of even more outdated looking supercomputers, maybe of IBM vintage. So that's the introduction. So let me talk about like why I'm talking about this episode in particular. So when I was a kid, I saw it for sale in a video store somewhere, who knows, maybe at like a Pathmart or something, some New Jersey, crud store. Like there was like Caldor and Pathmark, I don't know, some places where my mother took me on interminable shopping trips you had to go on as a kid and just watch her shop for things. This video was probably sitting on the shelf for like $2.99, and I saw that it was Spider-Man, who I loved, but more especially it had the X-Men. Which I you know, back then there's no YouTube. These things were not playing in syndication really. So it was like a gem from the blue, out of the blue. And I said, I gotta have this. So my mother's like, yeah, sure, why not? And this episode was extremely informative to me. It was like amazing. I think I probably got this tape after the X-Men animated series had premiered, the one we know and love. So it was like really amazing to see a different take on them and a different animation style, and seeing the X-Men like roam around in their vintage late 70s gear that we, you know, saw in the Dark Phoenix comics, which I'm sure I had read. So I loved this tape so much. I knew it was cheesy. Maybe it was 10 or 11 or 12, but I didn't care. It was just as good. My taste had not yet evolved quite so much, so it was just as good as the current modern X-Men show. I didn't care that it looked different. or sounded different. I was mightily entertained. And it just always stuck with me all these years, you know, just rewatching it now, the music, the corny, like, you know, someone's really pressing into that wah-wah pedal and plugging that guitar into an overly digitized, you know, processor or something, and just the wacky orchestra playing along with these 1970s discos guitars. Marvel always a little bit outdated when it came to music references. I mean, Dazzler famously, when they premiered her as a new comic book idea in the X-Men comics, they wanted a disco superhero, and by the time Shorty came out, disco was already a little dated then. So this cartoon following in that bold tradition, and the episode opens with Firestar or Angelica doing some homework or reading a book, and Iceman starts snowing on her. And like I said, Iceman voiced by Bobby Drake. Now, I don't know if I could copy Frank Welker's voice. my voice is actually a little charred right now from being so sick. I really wanted to try to attempt to do these voices. I don't think I can do Frank Welker's voice, but it's very like doofy. It's essentially Fred from Scooby-Doo. He's just not even trying. And he's saying, hurry up, Angelica. We got to go to the X-Men reunion. And so it's cool to see them like transform into their costumes. Iceman more particularly, he covers himself up with a block of ice and smashes it out with both his arms, sending ice flying everywhere in their apartment. I guess they're not concerned about the mess and water melting everywhere. Angelica, she just sort of like, there's like a red concentric circle of energy that sort of goes in and explodes out, sort of like how you would imagine a supernova exploding. And then she magically transforms into her bright yellow outfit and red mask. And so they're both kind of ridiculous. And so they have a reunion, an X-Men class reunion, which seems like a silly yet semi-logical premise for an episode. You know, both these, both Bobby and Angelica have graduated from the X-Men, but to go to college, which doesn't quite make so sense. So those X-Men, their high school years, and then when they meet all the X-Men, they're all clearly adults, so it's not like they're the next class. And then it just plays on the whole like confusing theme of, are the X-Men students or are they adults that work as a paramilitary force? Are they teachers? Are they still learning? I don't know what's going on. So that, I love that this episode plays right into that. And it's just, you know, Professor X is holding a class reunion just for those two. I mean, there's clearly other X-Men from this era that don't appear in this episode that you would think would also come back from the for the reunion, namely Jean Grey and Beast. They're nowhere to be found. But they run into Spider-Man, who's out catching bank robbers. And actually, I love everything about Spider-Man in this era of animation. When he shoots his webs, it sort of plays like a sci-fi, like laser, like a muted laser blast noise. It doesn't make like a thwip noise that you would think. It's like they're being shot through like weird cylindrical, weird cylindrical cannons that reflect the noise in a very sci-fi way. And he shoots like this big web puddle on the ground that the bank robbers walk into, and it's real sticky, and there's this great satisfying goopy noise. This episode, I'm really encouraging you guys just to watch, just for the sound design alone. It's really funny and really dated, and just so many of the creative choices they made, you can't tell if they did it for budget reasons or just because they didn't really get the source material, or if they're just sort of reflecting the spirit of what Marvel was at the time, which I'm not really sure they were doing exactly, because Marvel was pretty sophisticated actually by the early 80s. I mean, you already had the Phoenix runs, and you had Roger Stern's run on Spider-Man. Like, those comics were pretty gritty and interesting and sophisticated. So this is definitely the cornier, kitschier side. I mean, it probably has a lot to do with, if I had to guess, Stan Lee probably had a big say in these production meetings and wanted to keep things much in the spirit of the 1960s. He was not reading the more modern comics of the era. So, and that is a big topic of discussion in the previously an X-Men book that Stan Lee was, of course, brought on board as an executive producer, and his ideas were just so dated. He just wanted to redo basically what they did here in the early 80s, and they had to strongly resist him and sort of essentially throw him out of the creative room because his ideas were so lame. So, if you ever want to see Stan Lee creatively helm a Marvel cartoon, look look no further than Spider-Man: His Amazing Friends, and you'll get an idea of what that would have been like. Spider-Man sees his amazing friends, and they're all teammates. Like I said, they're all like living together in a dorm room, going to Empire State University and fighting crime on the side. And he's like, "Oh, you're going to an X-Men reunion? Can I come too?" And they're like, "Nah, you're not invited. X-Men only." And they just like coldly leave him. It's like, why not invite him? I don't know. So Spider-Man is just sort of left alone with nothing to do. But then out of nowhere, and this is an element of the episode I forgot, Juggernaut comes. There's so much going on in this 24-minute episode. It is just crammed, filled with details and subplots and backstories. It's crazy. So, like I said, there's so much going on, I forgot about Juggernaut. And he comes marching in. Who's ever voicing him has a ridiculous Shakespearean accent. He's like, "I am the Juggernaut! I've come to destroy my brother, Charles Xavier." He's got like a real Shakespearean quiver in his voice, and he's also speaking through a megaphone. So not quite like the Canadian sort of Juggernaut we get in the more modern X-Men series in the 90s, but just as ridiculous. And, you know, he's just announcing his intentions in the middle of Midtown Manhattan, smashing through walls. Also, curiously, in Midtown Manhattan, completely unpopulated with people. The streets are bone dry of human beings, except for Spider-Man, Juggernaut, and we saw two bank robbers, and that's about it. So Juggernaut is causing mayhem, just announcing to a crowd of no one that he wants to kill Professor X. Just walk to the mansion and, you know, knock it down. I mean, that's essentially what the plot was of the Juggernaut episode in the X-Men animated series. He just went to the mansion and knocked it over, trying to kill Professor X. And that's, like, essentially the plot, I think, of his first appearance in the comics, too. So probably some Stan Lee influence there as well. But, like, just this idea that, you know, every once in a while, Juggernaut returns to the mansion to knock it over, and presumably Professor X has to wipe his mind of memories. You know, then I guess after a while, he regains his memories, and then he returns to knock the mansion over. It's like a wash, rinse, repeat cycle with Juggernaut. It's pretty humorous to me. And just so just that basic element that, you know, Juggernaut's just every once in a while going to return back, and the X-Men will have to do some construction work after they deal with him. But on his way, he meets Spider-Man, and Spider-Man, you know, tries his best to stop him. He sets up a spider web and throws, like, a girder at him, and that, of course, does nothing. He shoots some wet cement at him. It hardens, but Juggernaut uses some sort of red glowing energy to get through the cement. He doesn't even smash through it. Some other weird mystical power going on. And Juggernaut, like, knocks a building over, and Spider-Man's buried in rubble, which is sort of a classic Spider-Man predicament, him being buried underneath piles of rubble. It's made famous in a classic Spider-Man comic from the 60s, Stan Lee, Steve Ditko, where he's buried under some rubble, and he has to summon all his will and spider strength to smash through it. And then it's like one of the classic, like, drawn panels of Spider-Man ever. And then they reuse that idea again in Spider-Man Homecoming, the newest movie. The Vulture, you know, buries him under some rubble, and Peter Parker's sort of, like, left alone and buried, and he has to summon all strength to break through. He doesn't think he can at first, but, you know, spider strength is pretty ridiculous. Spider-Man's, like, his power level's, like, near 10. Although, you know, not in terms of Marvel trading cards. We know 10 is Galactus or Silver Surfer, so, but you know what I'm talking about. He's stronger than you think he is. Which is, you know, something that I really appreciated. I just rewatched I rewatched Captain America Civil War. It was on TV or something, and I was just laying in bed sick. I was actually watching it on mute because I found that I was so sick. When you have stuff playing with the volume on, it invades your fever dreams and you go crazy. Like, I was watching Star Trek, the original series on Netflix, like the one from the 60s with Captain Kirk and Spock, and that I fell asleep in, like, a fever dream with it on, and I was having the most violently insane Star Trek dreams, and it was no fun. So then the next day, when I was watching TV, I realized I had to have the sound off while I was laying there in abject pain and, like, sweating fever to have the sound off. But you still need something to, like, watch to keep you from going truly insane. I realized that the middle ground was having no sound on. Sonya right now is laying in her bed in, like, she's probably having fever dreams right now listening to me, like, yap in the apartment about all this stuff. So I feel bad for her, but she gave me her blessing to go ahead and do this. Anyway, it's been a long, long weekend. Not fun. But what was I talking about? Oh, Spider-Man. So he's buried in rubble. We'll discover he actually doesn't break through it in the traditional way, as I was saying. But whatever, we'll get back to him. So meantime, he's okay, by the way, if in case you're worried. Meantime, Firestar and Iceman travel to the X-Mansion in Westchester, New York. This is why I love seeing Iceman in a cartoon. Just the way he gets around is so awesome. Just spraying an ice bridge wherever he goes is just like wonderful fantasy, and translates great to cartoons. So they arrive outside the perimeter, and they meet Angel and Storm. Angel, an original member, obviously, although he's decked out in, like, not the original Angel costume, the blue and yellow one. He's wearing, like, the more 1970s version. It's, like, white and crimson red with the yellow halo on the white part of his chest. And he obviously hasn't been turned into Archangel yet. And it was interesting because there's a couple of, like, alternatives to this outfit. There was, like, he's wearing the crimson red one here. But I think he more traditionally wore the blue one. It was the same outfit, just in blue. I'm not sure. Maybe the red one was more popular at the time. But still cool to see that, like, vintage era of Angel drawn. And then Storm arrives, too. And she is wearing her sort of classic late 70s outfit, the black leather cape and the weird, like, lingerie bondage that leaves little to the imagination. Although, I guess for the purposes of animation, they made her top and her bottom white, because I think if it was all black, it would have blended together. But so she's got, like, a sort of like a white latex outfit with the black cape. And, you know, but with the fabulous flowing white hair. And then I love Bobby sees Storm, and he's like, wow! He's, like, super turned on by her. It's pretty funny. Storm, a stunning, sexy character. And also, weird animation choice in the show. Iceman's eyes are green when he is Iceman. Kind of like a weird, eerie effect. I don't know why they did that. I guess maybe it wasn't distinctive enough if his eyes were blue as well. Ice blue. But also we get to see, talking about Iceman's means of transportation, he's sort of, like, blasting an ice bridge in midair to stay, like, to hover, which is bizarre, too. There's, like, a scene where he's just talking to Angel in the middle of the sky with Firestar flying around, and because he can't fly, he just has to constantly keep shooting, like, one spot of the air to make it an ice bridge, which doesn't really make sense, because once the ice bridge is formed, you think it's, like, solid up there, unless it's a hot day and it's, like, melting immediately and he has to keep creating ice. I don't know. But just, I just love little details like that. So then they come down to the mansion, where we meet Professor X, who's got a ridiculous voice. Very, like, everyone's got, like, a weird semi-Shakespearean voice, except for a few notable exceptions. And then they meet Cyclops. I don't even know what to say. He's wearing his classic 1970s outfit, the blue unitard with the yellow underpants and the blue skull cap over his head. And a nice little touch is that they give him... Under his visor, he's got the big, bulky, yellow visor, but it's got, like, the two red eye slivers not connected in one, like, red eye beam, as maybe the Cyclops we see in our animated show. It's, like, it's two, like, red rectangular slits for eyes, which I really appreciate that touch. It's very cool to me, very sort of, like, retro-futuristic. And Cyclops' voice is freaking ridiculous. It's so deep and so corny. It's just, like... the most Boy Scoutiest Boy Scout voice ever Boy Scouted in the history of Boy Scouts. He's like, hello, Firestar, I am Cyclops. I mean, it's just, I can't even do it justice. It's like even a few notches deeper than that. He's like, meet our other team member, new team member, Wolverine. And now here's Wolverine. So we discussed with Eric and Julia Leewald, the comic book writers, you know, we were talking about Pride of the X-Men, which was the aborted X-Men pilot episode from like 1989, and in that episode Wolverine had an Australian accent, and they said they did that because Crocodile Dundee was a popular movie at the time and they wanted to capitalize on the Australian market. Here, this is like 9 or 7 years earlier. There's no excuse why Wolverine has an Australian accent. It makes no sense. Someone at Marvel just did not get the memo, and here we have Australian animated Wolverine again. Completely ridiculous. He's like, hey, my name's Wolverine. You want some fruit? And That's his introduction. He asks Firestar if she wants some fruit, and he lets loose a claw, and it makes a little fruit kebab. It's like, no, Wolverine, I don't think anyone wants to eat fruit off your claws. But also, the funniest thing about his claw, the noise his claws make when they retract, it makes like a squirting noise, like almost like a farty squirting noise, which I was thinking about it for a second. First, I thought it was just stupid, like, sound design. They had no idea what they were doing. But the other thing is, like, are they trying to capture the noise of just, like, skin puncturing and nothing else? It's so gross when you think about it. It's like a little... I can't even do it. But it's just like a little squirting noise. It's like, is that his skin squirting open? It's just, like I said, gross no matter how you cut it. So Wolverine, like a big misfire in sound and vocal design, but funny nonetheless. Although he is wearing his classic, like, yellow, you know, late 70s outfit. Nice to see. You know, essentially the outfit he wears later in the X-Men animated series. I didn't get a look at his belt, if he had the X belt or the belt buckle. I think in this era he had a belt buckle, not the X logo. He definitely has the X logo in the series that we know and love. But here, probably just the belt buckle. So we meet our new X-Men. Not exactly, like, a weird roster. I mean, Angel wasn't really on the team at this time. I mean, he kind of made cameos, I think. I'm not sure. And we're talking about, like, 1982. I'm not really sure who was on the team. I think Cyclops had left at some point, and Storm was leading the team, and, you know, there's no Kitty Pryde here. Although I think, like, if you watch Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, Kitty Pryde does come in another episode. Like, there is another X-Men episode out there, with maybe we see a few different mutants. And then Kitty Pryde, actually known as Sprite in this iteration, which is really bizarre and just really strange, because I think she's only known as Sprite in, like, one issue at the time. Like, there's one issue, she's like, I think my name should be Sprite. It's before she became Shadow Cat, and then later just Kitty. I don't know. I don't know how long the Sprite name stuck, but it's just weird that they would actually include it in the show. Although, Kitty Pryde not in this episode. And so, I have been talking for almost a half an hour now, and I still haven't even gotten to the guts of this episode. It's just like I said, so much crazy shit happening. So now, it's a class reunion for just two people, and Firestar takes it upon herself to just tell her origin story. Well, Storm asks, she's like, Firestar, what's your origin story? She's like, I'll tell you. And here we go. So to me, this was the most memorable part of the episode. Firestar's, like, super annoying origin. And like I said, she was created specifically for this show. So this was kind of an important episode for the show to make, in a way, to establish her. And they kind of retcon her into the X-Men team, which, you know, she obviously wasn't. Although later she was retconned into the X-Men universe in the comic books. I guess she proved popular enough that, you know, she appeared in some comics. I've never actually saw Firestar or read Firestar in an X-Men comic. Or if I had, I've totally forgotten. But interesting enough that I just love that, you know, no matter how bad the idea, how slight the character, at some point the Marvel writers will write a character in, you know, to the continuity somewhere along the line. So here we go, Firestar's backstory. So, you know, she grew up poor. That's like a big character trait. You know, her mother, I guess, died or went away or something, and it was just her and her dad. Her dad's a construction worker, and they didn't have they live in, like, a dirty old house. And, you know, and she, so that, but she loved her dad. So, you know, despite the fact that they're poor, they had a happy life in childhood. And Angelica had trouble making friends. So she meets this one girl who's been mean to her whole life. Her name is Bonnie, and she's got one of those really obnoxious, like, 1970s voices. It's hard to describe, but you know it when you hear it. It's like a real spunky, just, like, bratty voice that was real popular in cartoons at the time. And she begins, like, 15 years of tormenting this poor Angelica. So, you know, first she meets her in the park, and they're building a snowman, and Angelica says, can I play? And Bonnie says, no, you're too poor. But when Angelica gets close to the snowman anyway, it starts melting. So her mutant power is activating a little earlier than maybe they're supposed to. I mean, it's not like a hard, fast rule that mutant powers have to come on at puberty. So, you know, her mutant power is coming on, like, at age, like, 6 or 7 here, or maybe 7 or 8. So she's melting snowman, and that's when Bonnie starts calling her a Jinx. She calls her Miss Angelica Jinx, and that's a sad nickname that sticks with her throughout most of her teenage years. And then, you know, later on, she's still hanging out with Bonnie, I guess, you know, despite the fact that Bonnie and Angelica hate each other. When you're a kid, sometimes you're just forced to hang out with people you don't like, and even sometimes it's bullies. It's just, like, part of, like, what it's like to be a kid. Parents put kids together. There's birthday parties. There's, you know, like, weird get-togethers and things. So you have to, like, that's, like, one of the funniest parts about being a kid. You have to hang out with, like, a lot of, like, people you don't like. You really get your choice of friends or choice of playdate activities. So Angelica's at Bonnie's birthday party or something, and Bonnie's being really mean to her. She gives her a crappy doll to play with, and then Angelica ends up melting it, and she ends up melting the dollhouse, which Bonnie is so proud of. And so, you know, it's like, in a weird way, Bonnie melting the snowman's one thing. A snowman, no one owns a snowman. But destroying Bonnie's toys, while deserved because Bonnie's such a brat and a bully, it's like Bonnie does have a legitimate gripe against Angelica. You know, she's destroying her property, I guess. I mean, not intentionally, but, you know, in from Bonnie's point of view, maybe she feels like, you know, I really have a reason to hate this girl. Although none of them, I guess, know about mutant powers or suspect she's a mutant, so we don't get, like, the classic, like, you're a mutant, I hate you because I'm bigoted storyline in this episode. It's entirely, like, based on just Bonnie disliking her because she's different and thinks that because she's, you know, bad things happen when Angelica's around. Although we get enough of, like, she's such a brat that we get enough of, like, implied bigotry anyway, that you get the idea that, you know, if she had known she's a mutant, she would have hated her. And then we get even some more scenes growing up. Like, I mean, this, like I said, there's so much going on in this episode. They're in a campfire. There are a bunch of Girl Scouts together. And that's another scenario where if you're a kid, you're forced to hang out with people you don't like, you know, if you're in the Girl Scouts or the Boy Scouts. And Angelica sabotages her fire, but luckily Angelica has the power of fire, so she can make a more impressive fire than Bonnie and her friends. And that actually starts to turn the tide a little bit. Angelica gets some self-confidence from her powers, and people are drawn to Angelica because she can make cool stuff happen like that, even though no one really catches her using the power explicitly. So that makes Bonnie even more enraged and jealous. And then, you know, what else is going on here? They grow up some more. There's a great scene where one day Bonnie just, like, meanly grabs Angelica's book report as she's walking to school and throws it into the air, and all the papers are scattered in the wind. And Angelica says, "This is when thanks to Bonnie, I had the greatest day ever in my life." And she's chasing down the book report, and she finds herself flying without realizing it and gets all her papers. But when she realizes she's flying, she's, like, you know, ecstatic and enthralled. And I just – that – to me is a great bit of writing, that when a character discovers they can fly, it's such an amazing wish fulfillment moment. It's one of the reasons people love comics, and going back to the original Superman in the 1930s, just the idea that someone can fly and it's their power that they own, it just dazzles, like, the youngest children's minds. It's like the ultimate power fantasy. And they really capture it here. Like, she's flying around. She even forgets about going for school for a minute. I mean, like, why even go back to school? If you're 16 and you learn you can fly, you would probably just start flying around the country, just not caring about anything. So what a magical time in Angelica's life. But she does realize she has to go back to school. And the teacher's like, "Angelica, why are you late to school?" Like, all the adults' voices in this cartoon are so stilted and, like, overly dramatic. It's weird. It's almost as if you could take the Peanuts voices, which are and you were able to put it through a translator. That's what it would sound like. So stiff and unfunny. And like I said, Shakespearean is a good word in a way. And so it's ridiculous. But she doesn't blame Bonnie about the book report. And again, she wins over Bonnie's friends because she says, "Oh, Angelica's not that bad. She didn't rat us out." But Bonnie still hates her. She's just so consumed with hatred and jealousy at this point. I think that's, like, a classic storytelling trope in, like, magical fantasies. When one character who is picked upon, like, gets a supreme advantage, be it be, like, magical powers, or they grow up to be really beautiful, like, go from an ugly duckling to a beautiful swan, the character who's always been in the position of dominance, usually a bully type, like, the fact that the new character is getting all these advantages, like, really, like, messes up their internal circuitry, and it drives them to, like, deeper and deeper levels of depravity. Like, I'm trying to think of, like, examples. I mean, I don't know, like, Carrie the movie in Stephen King novels, like, a classic example of that. There's, like, other examples examples too, where someone like altering like the natural sort of scheme of things really throws off like the order, the established order, and it makes all the characters go crazy. That's probably a Shakespearean concept in itself too, in a weird way. Like when things are like when the kingdom is not in sorts, like all the animals start acting crazy. So in a sense, Bonnie is like driven like more insane by the fact that Angelica is actually turning out to be really cool and popular and pretty too. So she it forces Bonnie, and her friends are saying like, let go of it, Bonnie. No one cares about this childhood like name calling anymore. But Bonnie like can't let go of it because she's obsessed. So I think that like again, like this is a corny ass episode of cartoonery, but still like some really good classic storytelling tropes. Like it's the one thing Marvel was always good at, is translating classic narratives in for their purposes, for their silly superhero dramas. And in a way, it's just why people love Marvel. I mean, as I'm thinking about it, it's like they boldly like updated like classic storytelling for the modern age and did not apologize for it. Be it Shakespeare, be it the Bible, be it just like whatever sort of like classic fiction, like whatever like narratives have been floating around forever, they just updated it in an interesting way. And it like led to the explosion of, you know, popularized science fiction that we have today, and the things that just this type of storytelling that popular culture loves today. And, you know, like almost, I wouldn't say it's like a new religion, but it's new myth making, that it's just in people's minds. And people, I don't know. It's like Black Panther came out this weekend and it's an enormous hit. Like superhero fatigue, I guess not. Like, and we'll talk about Black Panther soon, once Sonya and I are well enough to see it. Like I said, Marvel had some kind of magic formula, and like no matter how primitive the storytelling, like I said, with this corny early 1980s thing, it still translates and still worked. I was still entertained watching this at age 34. Oh, by the way, it was my birthday last week. Happy birthday to myself. But I always say on this podcast I'm 33, but now I am 34, so another age closer to my funeral. Getting bleak there, but appropriate because I've been so sick this weekend. Anyway, where was I? So now Bonnie's hatching this insane scheme to steal a gold-plated trophy that's going to be awarded to the winning football team next week. And, you know, the dean puts Angelica in charge of guarding it for some reason. And so Bonnie just has like a stupid scheme of stealing the gold-plated trophy and somehow making it all be blamed on Angelica. And then she's going to recover the trophy and say like, oh, I'm the one who found it in Angelica's locker. I'm a hero. You know, she pulls off the first part of her scheme and Angelica's suspended, even though she's insisting on her innocence. And then like her and her dad are reading the school newspaper where the headline is Jinx Jones suspended. High school newspaper headlines, quite dramatic in another era. I don't know if anyone, you know, I feel like in the 1970s and 1980s, a high school newspaper could have been a legitimate source of news journalism in a local community, believe it or not. It was just, let's just say it was a simpler time. And high schools in general, it was like more of an idyllic time in America, like at least in white America, you know, when it was all suburbs and low inflation and you could rent an apartment for $50 a month, like, and go to college for $100 a year, like whatever it was, like white people at their most economically swaggiest across all sort of classes, even into dipping into the lower class. So this is like an insane train of thought, I know, but just saying that, to a local community, a high school newspaper might even be a big deal, because also in that sense, like local sports are a big deal. I mean, and that's true to this day, especially in a lot of southern towns like Texas, where high school football reigns supreme, and other places down south. So people might be reading the newspaper, and it is like really embarrassing, and you might be covering like a real big local story there. So I don't know, that just struck me as like some weird, like, you would think it'd be like, oh, it's a cartoon, it's stupid, like no one cares about the school newspaper, but actually in that era it might have been a bigger deal than people realized. Now time's much more different. I think people now, we realize that, and also back then, like, I feel like even though, you know, I just feel like teenagers were older back then because economically it was such a different time. You know, right after you got out of school, a lot of kids were getting married right away. There's a lot more social pressure, especially from women, to get married, to have husbands, to have children. Right out of high school was not uncommon. For men, they didn't need to necessarily go to college. There's a lot of good work to be found, a lot of good union jobs. So right when you're 17, 18, it's like the teenagers were a lot more adult-like than they are today, where I feel like kids are so much more – it's just a different time where you need to go to college. You need to grow up a lot more. Kids are just teenagers are seen a lot more like children than they were back then, when they're a lot grittier and like immediately picking up a toolbox or something right out of high school and becoming like an electrician's apprentice or going to a coal mine or something, or working as a construction worker. So it's just like a different era, and it's just like a weirdly more working class, but also like in a more empowered working class. So those themes like came across to me. Is anyone still listening to this? I'm also sick and delirious, so the quality of this rambling to myself might be lower than it is usually. I don't have Sonya to temper me in all my wild flights of fancy. So thank you, true super fans. All right. So now with it, I don't even know why I'm talking about this. Now Angelica decides she needs to take action. She knows she's been set up, so she decides to knit her costume. I skipped over a whole scene where she saves her dad at a construction accident. Whatever, you know. She realizes she can use her powers to save people. But here she's, like, knitting her Firestar outfit for the first time. Another classic superhero scene of them making their costume. I love that stuff. It's so corny, so great. Honestly, Firestar's origin, very similar to Superman in a lot of ways. You know, discovering she can fly, making her own costume. It's... depends on the story of how Superman gets his costume in different eras. But, you know, this is like the classic corny 1940s superhero origin storytelling. So character knits their own costume. And then she marks Bonnie's car to track where the trophy is going, because Bonnie's like got some complicated plot where she's moving it from location X to Y. So I think she kind of just needlessly like fries the top of Bonnie's car, again destroying Bonnie's property. Okay, it's another story. She deserves it. Just to track her, but she's flying over the car anyway. Okay, anyway. So she sees the car the whole time. Okay, whatever. And then she, at the football game, she sort of, like, her whole plan is ridiculous. She just scoops Bonnie up, who's a cheerleader, and with a megaphone makes Bonnie confess in front of everybody. And Bonnie's kind of, like, shivering and terrified and, like, you know, embarrassed. And Firestar is just being really bold. She's like, "Dean Wilmer, this is the true criminal." And Bonnie's like, "Yeah, I did it. I'm sorry." And Firestar's like, "Ha ha ha," and drops Bonnie in some mud. And Dean Wilmer rightfully says, it's like, "You can't terrify someone into confessing, Firestar. You need proof." And she's like, "Okay, proof? You got it." And then she flies and captures Bonnie's boyfriend, who was in that moment planting the trophy in Angelica's locker. But, you know, it's almost at that point, like, just because she grabs the guy with the trophy, she could have just strong-armed him to do it anyway in case she was late or missed it. Like, she could have just grabbed the trophy from her locker and then grabbed this guy and, like, thrown his hands. Like, there's your proof. To me, that's, like, still not exactly proof. And because no one sees Firestar grab the boyfriend Dave with the trophy. It's just sort of, like, everyone just takes Firestar's word for it at the time, and he's dropped in mud too. Although, because he's a bully, classic bullies, they backstab each other. He blames Bonnie, and so the truth comes out, and Firestar, gets her revenge, and her name is cleared, and she flies off. And then, like, that classic Superman move, she, like, as soon as she flies off, everyone's like, "Where'd Firestar go?" And Jessica, like, strolls right into the scene. It's like, "Oh, hey, guys, what's up?" And everyone's like, "Jessica, you're innocent, we love you." Or Jessica, what's her name? Angelica? I don't know. I'm confusing all the names. So Firestar cleared. That's her origin story. And then, it's like right at that moment after the football game that the X-Men come to recruit her. And she gets into a little quick fight with Iceman. Again, classic hero versus hero Marvel storytelling bullshit, where Iceman just appears. He's like, "Hi, I'm Iceman." It's like, "I need to talk to you." And she's like, "You're not going to talk to me. I'm going to start fighting you right now." And they start fighting. Fire versus Ice, who wins? We don't really even get to see. Angel flies in, calms her down, and says, "Hey, join the X-Men." And then we get even more backstory. This episode, it's, like, endless. And like I said, it's only 24 minutes. We see her fighting in the danger room. And then she... She fights Magneto, who she refers to as Magneto, which is hilarious that they got the pronunciation of Magneto wrong. Although, like we talked about in a previous episode, Magneto, known as Magneto in Poland in the X-Men Apocalypse movie, and I always secretly loved that pronunciation of Magneto as Magneto. Very justifyingly, justifying in the sense that I said, oh, wouldn't it be funny if people just decide to pronounce it out loud as Magneto? It's like, who's saying what the pronunciation is or who's establishing it? According to this show, which predated our X-Men show, it was Magneto. So, I don't know. I think he was always clearly Magneto. But here, it's good to see Firestar referring to him as Magneto. Maybe she's Polish. Although her last name is Jones. Doesn't sound Polish to me, but who knows? Maybe her mother was Polish and gave her some sort of like Polish affect to her dialect. I'm just making stuff up. And then we see them fighting the Sentinels. And then, so that's cool. So the X-Men tackling the Sentinels. And then we see, finally, we're returning back to our Juggernaut, like, D-plot at this point. There's, like, an ABC D-plot. And, Spider-Man, he was buried in rubble, but he falls into the New York City subway. And conveniently, I guess, he sticks onto a subway and it's heading up to Westchester, New York. We can only presume. But then Juggernaut breaks into the X-Mansion, as he is prone to do, because he is Juggernaut. He smashes a wall down, and it looks like when he smashes the wall down that all the computers in the X-Mansion, we see they're painted on the, like, cement bricks of the X-Mansion. So, it's just, like, a weird animation. You'll know what I'm talking about if you see it. And so Juggernaut busts in. Cyclops immediately blasts him back like 100 feet back into the grounds of the X-Mansion. And it's here we get to hear more of Wolverine's claws squirting out of his skin. It's kind of gross. Iceman makes a big ice wall to slow him down. And Cyclops makes a really cool, he burns like a really deep dirt well into the ground, and he makes it over several like satisfying horizontal layers, so that once Juggernaut blasts through the punches through the ice wall, he falls into this dirt ground. Although I don't know how that's gonna stop. I think Juggernaut can jump pretty high. Maybe not. Maybe he's kind of like he can only trod across the ground very like slowly with like a real low center of gravity. I don't know what his jumping abilities are. But at this point, Professor X says, "You must remove his helmet. It's the source of his power." Which, you know, we know that his helmet is not the source of his power, and then that's even refuted in this episode. Once his helmet's finally taken off, Spider-Man like comes out of, is the one who saves the day. He spiderwebs Professor X out of his chair, just as Professor X is going to smash it, and then he's the one who rips the helmet off. And Juggernaut's like, "I don't need my helmet to use my powers." And you're like, "Oh, I guess it's not the source of his powers." And then Professor X is like, "No, but now I can use my mental powers on you to paralyze you and to make you freeze." And that's what he does. So Juggernaut defeated in the classic way, where some psychic just erases his memories and makes him stop, and that's the end of Juggernaut. So now the X-Men are all having a drink together. And Angelica's like, "I just want to thank the Juggernaut because he made this class reunion really memorable, because we all know class reunions are horribly boring." It's like, yeah, I guess they are. Are you just dissing yourself because you've been the star of this whole class reunion telling your super boring backstory, making me, Willie Simpson, repeat 30 years later in a podcast in excruciating detail? So I guess burn on me too. And then she, her and the other X-Men, they have a cheers to friendship, and they're all tipping their glasses at each other. And Spider-Man tips his glass at the viewer himself or herself. And that's the end of Firestar is Born, a ridiculous piece of animation from Marvel Animation Studios or Marvel Productions, whatever it was known as at the time. But a great artifact of the... You would never guess that from these humble beginnings that a multi-billion dollar conglomerate would be born from the corniest of origins. And it begs a lot of questions. It's actually incredible that, you know, this is what Marvel was. And it's the fact that the fans stuck through with it all these years, through decades of just corniness. I mean, the comics were always pretty consistently great, but anytime they came to the wider mass audience in the form of a cartoon or even a TV show like The Incredible Hulk, which is a pretty corny show and it has a lot of fans, but you know what I'm talking about. I mean, the fact that fans had to wait until the 1992 for the X-Men animated series, which is the first serious take of any Marvel property, is a real testament to just fan loyalty. And the fact that people knew that these stories, there's something to them that the staying power has just never gone away. Like I said, Black Panther, a C-level hero from the Avengers universe, essentially, in the Fantastic Four universe, who never got his due at the time, throughout all the time when Spider-Man and X-Men were super popular, and the Fantastic Four even earlier than that, and the Avengers super popular, Black Panther always a side character. He finally gets a movie, and his movie does $220 million in its opening day weekend. That's freaking crazy. And that's after 18 previous MCU movies made, not counting all the Spider-Man movies, not counting all the X-Men movies and Fantastic Four movies and Hulk movies that aren't part of the MCU, and all the DC movies. It's the people are still hooked unbelievably to the Marvel universe and every little corner and back alley that it includes. And I know Black Panther is a lot more going on, social movement, cultural movement, representation of African Americans or Africans in major Hollywood movie. That's a big part of it too. But still, it's Marvel had the magic to make it work and to make it be a hit. And there's just something to that, and something insanely magical about Marvel. And really, I don't know, someone's gonna write a book about it one day. I mean, I know lots of books have been written, but just about how it had such staying power. And lastly, it goes without saying, I want to see a reboot of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. Give me a movie, give me a TV show, a new animated series. I want it gritty, though. I want the characters cursing, and I want violence and blood. No, I'm just kidding. I don't really want any of those things. But although a movie would be cool. Disney now theoretically going to control all their properties again. You could team Iceman up and with Spider-Man and have Firestar or the Human Torch. The Human Torch and Spider-Man were a big deal together in the 60s. They were rivals. They were always running into each other. What I loved about the 60s Spider-Man comics was that Spider-Man never got along with the other heroes. He was always fighting them. They never understood him. He never understood them. He was a weird outcast. He wasn't a goofy, I'm here to help guys character. He was kind of in his own way, he was super popular, but at the fringes of the Marvel Universe at the time. Not really accepted by the Avengers of the Fantastic Four. And another weird a thing that they captured really appropriately in when there's a Spider-Man X-Men cartoon crossover in the Spider-Man series that you guys all know about, where Spider-Man goes to the X-Men for help, and he's kind of they fight, and he's kind of thrown out and an outcast in a way, and Wolverine really is against him at the time right away. And it's that was really emblematic of the 60s comics, that Spider-Man would go for assistance at times or go to offer services, but he'd always be rejected in some weird way. But this is not that Spider-Man. This is the Spider-Man that's friends with everybody. Why not a Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends movie in the year 2035, when they've really dug the bottom of the barrel? I would pay to see it then at the age of 50 or however old I would be. So I hope you enjoyed this ridiculous rambling of mine. I wanted to do something fun before we start season 4 next week. We're going to have a special guest star, hopefully, if everything works out. And season 4, we're going to have some more guest stars lined up. It's going to be fun. We're going to be doing some more wacky episodes here and there, more movie episodes, as we're running out of regular cartoon episodes to do. And as we segue from the end of X-Men to the perhaps beginning of Spider-Man, which I know I keep talking about, but I like to let fans, remind them that we're going to carry on in one form or another once we're done with the X-Men. So that's all I got for this week. Sorry for the late episode. Sorry for no Sonya. She really wanted to do it, but she's just way too sick. She's been actually knocked unconscious. She has not made a peep, just laying in her bed as I'm recording this, within 10 feet of her by her computer. Let's hope that she gets better. Let's hope that I get better. Reminder to follow me on Twitter at Willie Simpson. Rate us 5 stars on iTunes. Goes a long way to helping us out. Join the X-Men Task Facebook group. Seek us out there. Become a member. We've had a lot of new members this week. A lot of new podcasts popping up, and a lot of people saying, like, hey, can I promote my podcast in your Facebook group? And I'm like, sure, why not? I mean, I don't know. You know, we've got a really tight-knit group there. I hope that they're getting some followers for their shows. I'm real supportive. There's the one group, the X-Minutes. I'll give them a shout-out on this episode. They're doing, like, all the X-Men movies. Not exactly minute by minute, because that would be insane, but sort of, like, chapter by chapter, which I'm assuming is, like, DVD chapter. And I really like their show. Those guys are really... they really have the right sense of humor, I believe, that you need to talk about this stuff. And they've invited me to be a guest, so we'll see if that happens. And I've invited them to be a guest too, so hopefully that comes together in the future too. And then there's some other guy too that I'm sorry if I get his name, but he's going to start his own DC animated podcast show. So the more the merrier, I say. The less pressure off Sonya and I when it comes to talking about Marvel cartoons. Great news, and I just want to say thank you guys again for all the well wishes concerning our health, and we'll see you guys next week. Goodbye.